official at Capernaum, there was a festival of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now in Jerusalem by the sheep gate there is a pool, called in Hebrew Bethesda, which has five porticos, and these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew he had been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me." Jesus said to him, "Stand up, take your mat, and walk." At once the man was made well, and he took up his mat and began to walk. Now that day was the Sabbath. The Gospel of the Lord. First glance seems to be all about location. In both Acts and the Gospel, we move through a gate to be near the water. I have some photos posted for you. I realize that on the doors, they're small. But on this side, we have what was the sheep gate in Jerusalem. So when you get closer, you can look at it. It's now the lion gate because a later emperor actually put lions, a relief of lions on it, but it was the sheep gate. And on this side, we just have a gate that's in Philippi. And then the smaller photos on the furthest on either side are the same. And those are of the shrine in Philippi down by the river where they now honor the spot where they believe Lydia was baptized. Who knows where along the river it was, but this is where it is commemorated. And inside that little white shrine building is this icon of Lydia, and it's difficult to see her because there's glass in front of it. And in the picture, you can see the people wrapped around her, like standing in front of her, reflected back, and a lot of the things that people have left for her or for her to bless are in front of that. So in Acts, when you're listening to the story, you get the feeling that this place down by the river wasn't exactly where Paul and his fellow missionaries had planned to profess their faith and evangelize, but this is where they ended up. Things haven't really been going all that well for Paul's second evangelism tour. He set out with Silas to visit the communities of believers in the region of Galatia, those that they had met on their first missionary trip. After visiting these new Christian communities, they decide to break new ground, moving into Asia Minor, where they are unsuccessful. And then northeast along the coast of the Black Sea, where again, they have no luck. Paul's go-to method is to approach the synagogue in town and preach to the Jews, and perhaps to find gathering places where he can speak to Gentiles. But as he moves beyond Syria and Galatia, Paul's finding it difficult to spread the gospel, to be an evangelist. The text says he's being blocked by the Spirit of Jesus, which seems particularly unfair, doesn't it? Eventually, Paul and company end up in Troas, a Hellenistic Roman port city located on the Aegean Sea, where Paul has this vision which calls him to Macedonia, modern-day Greece, and he goes. Actually, we all go. For some reason, this is when the writer of Acts decides to include us all. The account from here is written in the first person, plural. We go to Greece, to Philippi. Paul's first mission to the European continent, the furthest east he has ever been. Not only is Philippi situated on the Aegean, but it's on the Via Egnatia, the Roman road which connects Philippi to both the Adriatic and the Black Sea. So it's an advantageous is not her home. She is from Thyatira in Asia Minor, where Paul has just been. But now she lives here in Greece, in Europe, because her business is here. She is a supplier of the finest material, purple cloth. She sells to the richest people. In our world, she would be a designer to royal families and red carpet celebrities. Even as a woman in the first century, Lydia is somebody in the world. But she's not exactly whom Paul was expecting. But when Paul arrives in Philippi, going to all the places he normally goes when he enters a new city, we can assume that no one is interested in giving him an audience, because within a couple of days, he heads to the river, out of the gates of the city, and there, Paul finds a group of women who are praying. It's a place of prayer. Lydia and her household receive Paul, and Lydia is open to hearing the good news he shares of Jesus. She's a Gentile who has converted to Judaism and is ready to be baptized into this faith Paul makes real for her. She and her whole household will be baptized because the householder makes those decisions for everyone. Lydia is the first Christian baptized in Europe, and she becomes the foundational support for Paul's ministry in Philippi. Not only that, but she's a reputable merchant on the trade route to Europe. She deals with the wealthy and those in powerful positions. And now she's a Christian, a follower of Jesus in the way. It's reasonable to assume that she was instrumental in sharing the gospel beyond Philippi, opening up the spread of Christianity into Europe. Lydia may be one of the keys to the survival and the spread of the early Christian church. What might be different if Paul had been able to meet with the town elders or had decided that those women weren't worth the trouble? What might not have happened? But Paul goes through the gates of the city and down to the river and meets exactly whom he was meant to meet. Lydia, who would become a partner in ministry in her own right, vital and necessary to the spread of the gospel, even if the text can't say that outright. In our gospel text, we are also at a gate, and we are near the water, just past the sheep gate in Jerusalem, near the pool of Bethesda, where Jesus asks the man who has been ill for 38 years, "Do you want to be made well?" And the man answers, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I'm making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me." Jesus tells him to stand up, take his mat, and walk. And immediately, the man is healed. Obviously, there's a lot going on here. Not just that ominous final comment by the narrator. "Now that day was the Sabbath." This is an odd story. The man never asks to be healed. He never claims to be faithful. And Jesus doesn't do anything in order to heal him. He just tells him to get up and walk, and the man is suddenly able to. The man isn't then convinced that Jesus is the Messiah. He isn't even grateful. Actually, the man's testimony later in the same story will be used as validation for those who were persecuting Jesus. Yet Jesus keeps doing the life-giving work he is called to do without concern for the consequences or even the merit of the one he heals. The God whom Jesus makes known is a God who does not discriminate in giving good gifts. A God who wills that all may have life and have it abundantly. On Tuesday, I went to Auburn, driving the program featured professionals from law enforcement and the legislature and recovery specialists. And I can't help but consider this gospel text through the lens of our understanding and response to the drug problem overwhelming our communities. Through this lens, the sick man's explanation of being by the pool but unable to get anyone to help him to be healed is the embodiment of the excuses hundreds of passerby have used, so they didn't have to help him. It echoes the excuse we make so we don't have to help, whatever excuse it is. Maybe, oh, he just doesn't want to get better. If only he hadn't burned bridges with his family. He probably likes the attention. Another opioid addict. The government should step in. The church should help him. On and on and on. Anything so we don't have to stop and help him ourselves. Or spend our money to fix the system which allows this pool to be surrounded by so many people in need of healing, yet only one can be healed at a time? Excuses so we don't have to take the time to understand the depth of the problems involved and how we might make things better for everyone. Here's what I learned or had reinforced on Tuesday. Addiction is more powerful than just about everything else. The system is designed to make it nearly impossible to get clean and stay that way, even if you want to. The issues underlying drug use are complicated and often related to significant trauma. And 80% of those addicted to drugs are suffering from some form of mental illness or PTSD. Particularly our veterans, who make up a block of those in need of safe recovery. Yet without adequate recovery programs available, people suffer in endless cycles of addiction and small steps of recovery and then addiction again, without the tools for long-term recovery and wellness. We spend a lot of money on prisons and almost no money on recovery centers. The statistics are consistent and unambiguous. Putting people in jail doesn't reduce drug use in this country and hasn't since the 1970s. When we criminalize the people involved, we make it even more difficult for them to get the help and the healing they need. The stigma of drug use prevents people from being reconciled to their families and communities, and it feeds their underlying insecurities and pain, which contributed to their addiction in the first place. Which means there's a lot we can do to smooth the road to recovery for those in need of our care and consideration. If we'll stop making excuses and consider a change of hearts and minds. Jesus threw out all the excuses, and he changed the rules. The man no longer had to wait by the pool. He could be healed right now. He didn't have to be good enough, or faithful enough, or even grateful. Jesus came that all might have abundant life, and that was reason enough to heal and restore to community. So the question before us today is, how is God inviting us to see the world differently, to change our perspective and our systems, transforming our communities for the better, that all might have abundant life? As Archbishop Desmond Tutu has been known to say, there comes a point where we need to stop just pulling people out of the river. We need to go upstream